This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States,
a podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you,
a podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our latest episode of This is Democracy. Today, we will be discussing an issue that has made global headlines in recent years, but often received little serious attention, at least in the U.S. This is, of course, the island of Greenland and the increasingly important role of the Arctic and of Greenland in global politics and policy. We have the privilege of being joined today by Dr. Mikkel Runge Olsen. Dr. Olsen is a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies. His research interests include NATO and transatlantic relations, the Arctic, the Nordic countries, Danish foreign policy, and Danish diplomatic history. His theoretical interests include realism, foreign policy analysis, and political psychology. Dr. Olsen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get started, we'd like to begin, as always, with a poem. This is an unusual poem. It's taken from a video montage that was produced a couple years ago by a Greenland native and a native of the Marshall Islands about the continuing impact of climate change on places like Greenland. Those two authors are Kathy Jekniel Kijiner and Aka Niviana. It's called Rise, and this is an excerpt. I welcome you to Kalaallit Nunaat, Greenland, the biggest island on Earth, sister of ocean and sand. I hold these stones picked from the shores of Nuuk, the foundation of the land I call my home. With these rocks, I bring a story told countless times, a story about Sasuma Arna, mother of the sea, who lives in a cave at the bottom of the ocean. This is a story about the guardian of the sea. She sees the greed in our hearts, the disrespect in our eyes. Every whale, every stream, every iceberg are her children. When we disrespect them, she gives us what we deserve, a lesson in respect. Do we deserve the melting ice, the hungry polar bears coming to our islands, or the colossal icebergs hitting these waters with rage? Do we deserve their mother coming for our homes, for our lives? Well, Dr. Olsen, I think for a lot of Americans, the word Greenland conjures up images of polar bears or, as in this poem, of melting ice. Mm-hmm. But there's probably little understanding here of the history of Greenland and its current political situation. Could you explain for us why Greenland finds itself a part of Denmark today?
Yes, certainly. Well, it goes back for over 1,000 years, basically, when Norse people, it was Erik the Red, a Viking from Norway, from Iceland, actually, he was banished from Iceland and had to go somewhere, and he went to Greenland. Then he convinced a bunch of Icelanders to go to Greenland as well and start a Norse colony. They lived there for several hundred years. They may have had limited contact with the Inuits that also were present in Greenland at various points in time. But then after several hundred years, they die out. Mysteriously, we don't quite know why. And then fast forward to the 18th century, people in what is then Denmark, Norway, decide that, well, this island, Greenland, it's part of the realm. We haven't heard from them in a long while. We better go have a look at what they're doing, especially since at this point, the Reformation had happened in Denmark and Norway. And there was this worry, well, they are all Catholics up there. But when Hans Egede, that was the priest that ended up going, when he arrives, he finds no Norse people there anymore, since they had all died out, and finds instead the Inuits and decides to try to convert them to Christianity. And that sort of begins a colonial relationship between Denmark, Norway, and Greenland, that has been that develops over the centuries. The Greenlanders, the Inuit, they adopt Christianity gradually and becomes part of first Denmark, Norway, and then when Denmark and Norway breaks up, they stay part of the Kingdom of Denmark. And this relationship, as most colonial relationships, it develops over time, and the way that the direction that it goes is that the further up in history we come, the more independent Greenland becomes, and the more self-determination Greenland acquires. And that sort of brings us to the state of affairs today between Denmark and Greenland. And right now, the situation is thus that by law from 2009, it is clearly stipulated that Greenland has the right to go for independence. But in order to do so, Greenland will have to take care of all of its own affairs. And this has basically been sort of the big challenge in Danish-Greenlandic relations in recent times, is that there's no doubt that Greenland wants independence from Denmark. It's simply a matter of being able to take care of running a society on this immense island with a very small population. The Greenlanders are only 56,000 people. So making that work without outside assistance is tough. And that has, until now, sort of been a main reason for why Denmark and Greenland are still together. And where that will end, we will have to see. It's very much still a developing story.
Thank you for that. We're joined, of course, as well by Professor Jeremy Suri. Jeremy, would you like to ask the next question?
Of course. And much of what you just summarized so well, Mikkel, of course, is in the excellent article that you wrote for us that we published on our Substack. And one of the topics you also touched on in the article that I think we'd love to hear you talk more about is the way in which the United States, particularly during and after World War II, became involved in Greenland, especially for military affairs.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, the way the U.S. becomes involved in Greenland is in itself a fascinating story. And it begins with the occupation of Denmark by Nazi Germany in 1940. And the Danish ambassador to the U.S., Henrik Kaufmann, he is very appalled by the occupation and reacts in a fairly unusual way for a diplomat, in that he goes to the U.S. and says that he would like the U.S. to regard him as the true representative of a free Denmark, because Denmark has been occupied, right? And in order to sort of sweeten the deal, to convince the U.S. that he should be the true representative of Denmark, he offers the U.S. that if he is the true representative, he would have no problem allowing the U.S. to have military bases in Greenland. So this sort of kickstarts the U.S. presence in Greenland. The U.S. had had strategic interest in Greenland for a long time, has considered whether it would be possible to acquire Greenland before this time. But this is when the U.S. becomes involved in Greenland for real. And then what happens? Greenland plays a fairly significant role in World War II, allowing for transport of troops, aircraft, ships across the Atlantic, being sort of a stopping point. It's also important for weather predictions and that kind of thing. And so when it happens that World War II is over, the mood in the U.S. is that, well, these bases in Greenland, Kaufmann had only promised them for the duration of the war, but these bases in Greenland are pretty handy, and the U.S. would like to keep them. So this is the position that the U.S. takes. Denmark and the U.S. Is not able to sort of find a solution for this until Denmark and the U.S. becomes allies in NATO in 1949, and that leads to a treaty in 1951 where it sort of solidified that the U.S. can have a military presence in Greenland. And it's actually that treaty from 1951, it's been modified since, but it's pretty much still sort of the foundation of the U.S. presence in Greenland even today.
Right. And one of the largest U.S. air bases in the world, I think, is still in Greenland. It used to be called Thule Air Force Base. I think it's now called Pituffik, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. It's an important part of the U.S. missile shield. It sort of goes to underline that Greenland still certainly has an important strategic importance for the U.S. today.
What is the sort of current political state of Greenland as we speak right now? I know there has been, as I think you mentioned in your first answer, some discussion of Greenlandic independence and what that would look like. As Greenland has made, you know, headlines in the United States and across the world, how have people in Greenland reacted? How has this interacted or impacted the movement for independence in Greenland?
Well, I think one thing that bears to mind is that if you're talking about also Donald Trump's aspirations for acquiring the island, I think I should mention it's not the first time that Donald Trump has tried this. Donald Trump tried to acquire Greenland back in 2019, and the answer back then was also a no. And this is not just a Danish answer; it's most certainly also a Greenlandic answer. And the Greenlandic answer is that Greenland wants to be independent of Denmark, but Greenland does not want to simply switch out Denmark for the US. Greenland wants true independence. And in that perspective, Donald Trump's plans of the US swooping in and taking over has not had much traction on the Greenlandic side.
That makes sense. What larger American strategic interests besides these military bases lie in Greenland? Why has Greenland attracted the attention of President Trump, do you think?
Well, I think we can sort of talk about three main reasons, at least if we take what Donald Trump says seriously, then we can say, well, there are the broader security interests. I've touched on some of them already. It has to do with the base already there, right, for tracking ballistic missiles, but it also has to do with monitoring the skies for Russian fighter planes, stuff like that. It has to do with Greenlandic waters, keeping track of Russian potentially nuclear-armed submarines. So all of that's sort of the core of the security argument, that the U.S. Wants to keep track on primarily Russian activity in the Arctic, but also to an extent on possible Chinese activity in the Arctic as well. So that's the security one. Then we have an economic interest. Now for Donald Trump, that very much ties up to Greenland's vast mineral wealth, especially rare earth minerals, important for the tech industry. And this argument, the argument from Trump goes that the U.S. needs to make sure that these resources are utilized for U.S. purposes, basically. There is one, puzzling element to that argument insofar as from a Greenlandic perspective, the Greenlanders have always been fairly open, or has long been fairly open, to the fact that they want investments in these kind of things. They want investments into resource extraction. A very sort of common quote used here is that Greenland is open for business. So in that sense, there isn't actually all that much that has prevented the U.S. from coming in and opening mines and whatnot in Greenland. So one might ask, why haven't the U.S. companies gone in and invested? And that very much has to do with simply the business case not always really being there. And therefore, when we talk about Greenland, but actually when we talk about resource extraction from the Arctic in general, it's very important to sort of separate, on the one hand, yes, there are a lot of resources in the Arctic, but on the other hand, the cost for extracting those resources can also be very high. That has to do with the harsh climate, great distances, the lack of infrastructure, all those kinds of things. So it's not enough that there are a lot of mineral wealth. It also needs to be profitable to actually extract it. And that has been a problem in the Greenlandic case in particular. And then, of course, we have reason number three, which is this MAGA idea of making America greater, this idea of territorial expansion for its own sake. And that, of course, is speaking sort of from a Danish perspective, that's harder to really say that much about, other than that the Danish government does not like that, right? That Trump seeks territorial expansion in the Kingdom of Denmark.
Mikkel, of course, this discussion of Greenland is occurring within a larger Arctic space, one of the regions of the world that's transforming before our eyes because of climate change. There are many countries interested in this region beyond Denmark and the United States, of course, Norway, Russia, China. How does the dispute, if we might call it that, over Greenland fit into at least the larger geopolitical vision for the Arctic that Denmark has?
Well, it fits very poorly into that perspective, right? It's the basic, up until roughly 5-10 years ago, the Danish and Greenlandic Arctic strategy was one where it was hoped that the region could be kept free of international conflict. There was this idea of Arctic exceptionalism, that it was possible to cooperate in the Arctic, even amongst actors that was not normally able to cooperate, and that was primarily between Russia and the West. But that began to break down gradually already with the first Ukraine crisis back in 2014. And then when we get to 2019, we're sort of at the point where great power tensions in the Arctic were so great that this idea that the Arctic was a special place had to be laid to rest, unfortunately. But what sort of characterized that period and up till today was, of course, that Denmark always saw this rising conflict as one between the U.S. and the West on the one side, and then Russia and possibly China on the other. I think it was most certainly a great surprise to both Denmark and Greenland to have to look at the U.S. in an adversarial perspective. I mean, the U.S. had been the cornerstone of Danish foreign and security policy for 75 years. So having that destabilized in such a manner was probably a fairly shocking thing for Danish politicians this year.
What do you think this history, particularly the history of Danish involvement in Greenland and American involvement in Greenland, can say about the future of conflict and competition in the Arctic, especially as climate change seems to open up more possibilities in the Arctic?
Well, I think it's made conflict scenarios in the Arctic vastly more complicated because, as I said, we thought about the possibility of conflict in the Arctic sort of in a fairly narrow the West versus Russia or the West versus Russia and China kind of perspective. But now this division within the West that this has caused, because let's face it, it's not just about Denmark and Greenland. It's also about, I think, the rest of the Western Arctic countries being a little bit worried about what it means for them that the U.S. has taken this position. It definitely changes this fairly unified Western position in the Arctic that I think you could often find in just a year ago. So in that sense, it makes it much more complicated to predict what's going to happen.
And how do you think we should think of Greenland, particularly when it comes to climate change? I think, we began with a poem about rising sea levels and melting ice in Greenland. And it seems like this is part of the reason that strategic interests in Greenland have come to the fore. What role, if any, do you think that this plays in this strategic calculation?
Well, I think climate change plays multiple roles when it comes to the Arctic and when it comes to Greenland. On the one hand, Greenland and the Arctic is sort of the canary in the coal mine. Global warming is happening faster in the Arctic, and it's happening faster in Greenland than elsewhere. And it's sort of a forewarning as to what's in store for the rest of the world with climate change. On the other hand, climate change, the way it hits in the Arctic and in Greenland in particular, there are damaging effects, to be sure. I mean, once it can be damaging to infrastructure that places that used to be frozen all year round all of a sudden melt. It can destabilize for sure, but that there are also new economic opportunities in the case of Greenland, because as I said, one of the main limitations for resource extraction in Greenland is the harsh climate. So to the extent that that climate becomes more accessible, that can give new economic opportunities for Greenland. Also in terms of fishing, we see that as the climate changes, some fish stocks migrate north. And for some stocks, that means migrating into Greenlandic waters. So Greenland is in the curious position of also receiving some of the benefits of global warming, while at the same time, which we say, the traditional Greenlandic approach to nature and the region would be one, as you described in the poem, of one of preservation, right? So there's a tension there that Greenland is seeking economic development and for that reason has an interest in trying to get these resource extraction projects up and running. And at the same time, Greenlanders also want to protect their pristine environment. And one of the places you've seen this tension play out is in the Kvanefjeld project. It's a big project in Greenland where there was hope to extract rare earth minerals, but where the Greenlandic politicians have recently put a stop to the project exactly because of environmental concerns and concerns of the citizens that are nearby the project. So it's always there, that tension, the wish to preserve the environment and the wish for economic development.
Mikkel, what about other actors in the region? We've talked a lot about the United States and Denmark and the Greenlandic population. But what about Canada, Norway, Russia? What have their actions been surrounding Greenland and around larger Arctic security issues in recent weeks and years? I know this is a topic actually you've spent a lot of time studying.
Sure. So, I mean, if we just cover Canada and Norway first, I think Denmark currently has a bit of a common relationship with Canada in facing some of the same challenges from the Trump administration. The Trump administration wanting to add Canada as the 51st state, but beyond that, even, I mean, both Canada and Norway would be sympathetic to Denmark and Greenland having to decide this matter on their own. When it comes to sort of larger security issues, these countries have also generally been able to find fairly common footing. And then that brings us to Russia, which is, the Arctic actor that Denmark used to focus most of its Arctic policies to deal with, right? Because for Russia, the Arctic is of paramount importance. And there are several reasons. First of all, we have the strategic regions, and they mirror the U.S. to an extent. For Russia, one of the most important parts of Russian strategic deterrent is its nuclear-armed submarines with its northern fleet, which is located at the Murmansk Peninsula in the Arctic. And so for Russia, safeguarding those nuclear-armed submarines and making sure that those submarines can make their way to the U.S. To threaten retaliation is a key component in Russian nuclear strategy, basically. So for that reason, the Arctic is very important for Russia from a security perspective. Then, in economic terms, the Arctic is of significant importance because the Russian economy is very much bound up on oil and gas. Now, up until now, most of that oil and gas has been land-based and it's come from Siberia, among other places. But as those sources of wealth begin to run dry, we've seen the Russians increasingly be interested in moving to the offshore in the Arctic region to try to set up new avenues of revenue for the Russian state. So in that sense, that has had a sort of multifaceted effect on the Arctic region in security terms, because originally that actually was a, what should we say, quote unquote, a good thing for Arctic security, because that meant that the Russians They were very motivated by the wish for economic gains in the Arctic, and especially in the parts of the Arctic that was established to be Russian. And therefore, they actually, for a long time, played quite nice in the Arctic in terms of trying to avoid conflict, exactly because they wanted to get started with those resource extraction projects. Now, that situation has changed somewhat. Cooperation between Russia and the West on extracting oil and gas from the Russian Arctic has stopped, and now the Russians are cooperating much more with the Chinese on this. And in this situation, you can see Greenland and the U.S. attempt at Greenland is a bit of a weird factor also for Russian approach to the Arctic. We've seen, on the one hand, we've seen sort of mixed messaging from the Russians. We've seen the Russian ambassador was out denouncing that the U.S. should do something like that in Greenland. But then more recently, Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has sort of opened up that maybe Russia would be okay with allowing the U.S. a free hand in Greenland, sort of with the not so subtle messaging that perhaps Russia could then get the same kind of free hand in Ukraine. So there are many factors at play here, for sure.
And with regard to Russia, I know just in the last weeks there have been Russian attacks, including one on the Copenhagen airport. Mm-hmm. Does Denmark perceive a pattern of Russian aggression mm-hmm. with regard to this region?
Well, I think now the recent drone operations in Danish airspace that was in Denmark proper. Copenhagen Airport, as you mentioned, right? And I don't think that was particularly Arctic focused. I think that was if it was an answer to any Danish policies, I would say it was more likely a response to a Danish decision made a few weeks ago to begin to invest in long-range precision weapons, which from a Russian perspective was seen to be directed, could be directed only towards them, right? And then it should also be seen as sort of a part of a general pattern of Russia testing the NATO countries in these weeks in terms of finding a gap in NATO defenses. So I don't see it so much in Arctic terms, also because I don't think that Danish or Greenlandic politicians are especially worried about a Russian invasion of Greenland. It's not quite that. When we think of Russia in the Arctic and as a sort of as a threat relations to Greenland, it would actually more be in terms of a threat to the U.S. because of this simple geographic fact that for Russian submarines and aircraft to pass from Russia to the United States, one of the fastest ways to get there is through the Arctic and through Greenland territorial waters and over Greenland if you're flying, right? So in that sense, I don't think that we sort of see Russia as a direct threat to Greenland right now, but we see that Russia can become a threat to the U.S. and use Greenlandic territory for that.
Well, Dr. Olsen, you've provided us with a sort of wonderful history of Greenland's place in the Arctic and then brought us down to the very important strategic considerations today. But to close, I want to ask a very different question. For those of our listeners maybe who have heard the way that Greenland has been discussed in the news by the President of the United States or in these sort of strategic economic ways, how can they, if they want to relate to Greenland and to the people of Greenland in a different way, what do you think that can look like? How do you recommend they get involved or learn more about this topic?
Well, I think what really is the issue here is what does the Greenlanders want, right? The age of colonialism ought to be over. And in that sense, this should be a matter of helping the Greenlanders achieve what they want to achieve, right? And I think what we've seen from Donald Trump in recent months is not that. What can the the U.S. population do? Well, arguably, I would actually say that the U.S. population, or at least a subset of them that has participated in certain polls, have actually already served a very constructive purpose, because my greatest reassurance in terms of the U.S. not invading Greenland is actually that the U.S. population has said, or polls conducted in the U.S. population are very clear that this would not be something that the American people want. So that fills me with a certain amount of hope, at the very least.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Mikkel Olsen. And thank you, Jeremy, for joining us as well. This has been a wonderful new episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Scott Holmes.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.
See you next time.